ओम ज्ञानतिमरन्दस्य ज्ञानञ्जना शलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः.
Welcome everybody. It's so nice to be here with you tonight. And welcome to everybody who joined us online. Vrindavan, I see you have a copy of the Ramayana. Good for you. There's a way in which during times of loss in our lives, or when we're chastised by a superior that we deeply admire, that we can become very sober and feel as if there's nothing more important than selfless service. We oftentimes, I should say, in the material world, I oftentimes am tempted by the thoughts of enjoyment in the material world to, you know, make a permanent stay here. Or there are many distractions. In fact, I heard just recently that the enterprises like Facebook are called distractionware. That's distraction, W-A-R-E. It's made just for distraction, to distract the mind. And sometimes when there's a traumatic experience in one's life, when all those subtle ideas of enjoyment suddenly drain out, or they're pushed away, and there's a strong focusing of the mind on the most important thing in life, which is to remember Krishna, pray to Krishna, and so forth. And we're in a precarious situation. We only have a very brief amount of time in this life to come to a disciplined state of remembering Krishna, and there are many distractions. So in remembering that selfless service, or the experience of selfless service, sometimes these traumatic experiences are useful, and one feels a kinchin, or I don't have anything. A kinchin means something, and not kinchin means I don't have anything. I'm bereft of everything in this world. And from that position, one may have an inkling of what it's like to offer selfless service, a prayer from the bottom of one's heart, and so forth. And we have a couple more verses in this same genre of selfless service. And the first one is in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, text number 34, 325-34. And the verse is Naikatmatam me sprihyanti kechin matpada seva birata mariha yinyonyato bhagavata prasajya sabajayante mama paurushani. The pure devotee who is attached to the activities of devotional service and who always engages in the service of my lotus feet never desires to become one with me. Such a devotee who is unflinchingly engaged always glorifies my pastimes and activities. Is this one we didn't read yet? You didn't read it? There are five kinds of liberation stated in the scripture. One is to become one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or to forsake one's individuality and merge into the Supreme Spirit. This is called ekatmanam, ekatmatam. A devotee never accepts this kind of liberation. The other four liberations are to be promoted to the same planet as God, Vaikuntha, to associate personally with the Supreme Lord, to achieve the same opulence as the Lord, and to attain the same bodily features as the Supreme Lord. A pure devotee, as will be explained by Kapila Muni, does not aspire for any of these five liberations. He especially despises as hellish the idea of becoming one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Prabhunananda Saraswati, a great devotee of Lord Chaitanya, said, Kaivalyam Narakayate. The happiness of becoming one with the Supreme Lord, is, which is aspired for by the Mayavadis, is considered hellish. That oneness is not for pure devotees. There are many so-called devotees who think that in the conditioned state we may worship the personality of Godhead, but that ultimately there is no personality. They say that since the absolute truth is impersonal, one can imagine a personal form of the impersonal absolute truth for the time being. But as soon as one becomes liberated, the worship stops. That is the theory put forth by the Mayavadi philosophy. Actually, the impersonalists do not merge into the existence of the Supreme Person, but into his personal bodily luster, which is called the Brahma-jyoti. Although that Brahma-jyoti is not different from his personal body, that sort of oneness, merging into the bodily luster of the personality of God, it is not accepted by a pure devotee, because the devotee is engaged in greater pleasure than the so-called pleasure of merging into his existence. The greatest pleasure is to serve the Lord. Devotees are always thinking about how to serve him. They are always designing ways and means to serve the Supreme Lord, even in the midst of the greatest obstacles of material existence. So, the eternal enemy of the soul is described by Krishna in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita as kama, or lust. We translate into lust. And one of our acharyas, I believe it's Vishwanath Chakravartita or Thakur or Baladev Bidyabhusan. I was looking at both books recently, so I can't remember which one said it. But he said, lust is overcome by rasa. And he quotes from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, where he says, where Krishna says, Vishaya vinivartante niraharasa dehina rasa varjam rasopyasya param jishva nivartate. And this word rasa comes that when one has a higher taste, one can overcome the lower taste. But in a sutra, it said, lust is overcome by rasa. Lust is overcome by rasa. It sounds reachable then when we hear it in a sutra, because you have lust on this side and rasa on the other side. And which is better? Well, kama, Krishna says, is appealing to those who are stupid, because it has a beginning, and an end. And therefore, smart people don't engage in it, because they've fortified their intelligence and they can understand that there are undesirable consequences for engaging in lust. Not only have they fortified their intelligence, but they've also practiced controlling their senses. It takes practice to do that. And when there is the combination of these two things, one has some strength, yogic strength. And above all, the taste is what is most important, because if somebody in an undisciplined state can get a little taste, even as a free sample, then he or she will make every arrangement possible to get it back. Because if an ant hears about a grain of sugar at the top of a skyscraper building, he'll get up there somehow, and everyone will follow him because there's some rasa in it for him. And that's what everyone's looking for, is rasa. So the devotees have a very fortunate situation. Even amidst the various kinds of liberation which are being mentioned here, they're very desirable for some people. Naishkarmyam apyachuta bhava varjitam nashobate gyanam alam niranjanam. This is mentioned by Narada Muni, that even those who have come to the point of self-realization, that is, beyond fruit of work, working for a result, for sense gratification, naishkarmyam, if they don't have this rasa, which is called in this verse the achuta bhava, means they have this emotion for God, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, something about his personal feature that attracts them. If they don't have that, then it's not very, it doesn't look very attractive at all. Nashobate gyanam alam niranjanam. It's not beautiful. It's nashobate mean. Nashobate gyanam. It's not nice. It's not that nice. But everyone else is thinking this is the ultimate goal of life. Dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Moksha means this liberation. But beyond that, the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Gaudiyas, are teaching this, what's beyond the four destinations of life. And that's prema pumarto mahan, beyond all the other destinations and what everyone else wants in this world is something unimaginable to most people. And that's prema, love for God. And therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he's in his Shikshashtakam, giving the progression of development for somebody developing this love of God, shows how he's giving up the world. And he says how one who's advancing in devotional service after chanting the holy name of the Lord and then realizing that I have so many anarthas, I can't barely chant the holy name, and then becoming very humble, saying, at least I'll become very humble. And then after that, nadanam najanam nasundarim kavitam va jagadisha kamaye mama janmani janmanishvare bhavatad bhakti rahaitu kitwai. This feeling, he's saying that I'm no longer interested in this material world. Nothing here interests me anymore. The world has become vacant. And you can offer a person who's had a full meal all the best dishes and say, all the best foods, and say, here, take one of these, take one of these, and it's just no longer attractive because you're already full. So there's a way in which one who has experienced rasa and is getting a taste for what's beyond all the things in this world, including liberation, then becomes obsessed with getting more of this rasa and is willing to forego everything else in the material world, and that includes these different kinds of liberation. In fact, it asking anything for the Lord interrupts the rasa. And therefore, the devotees are reluctant to even entertain a thought that I want something from Krishna, I want some kind of liberation or something in return. They're only absorbed in the mood of service to the Lord. Nadanam, najanam, nasundarim, kavitamba, jagadisha kamae. Jagadisha, like he's the Lord of the universe. Everything under his purview in this material world is no longer interesting to me. Mama janmani janmanishvare, even if bhavatad bhaktir haitu kitvai, I'm only interested in unmotivated, uninterrupted service to the Supreme Personality of God. That's a good position to be in. And here, again, the translation is, a pure devotee who is attached to the activities of devotional service and who always engages in the service of my lotus feet, never desires to become one with me. Such a devotee who is unflinchingly engaged always glorifies my pastimes and activities. And then the purport continues. The Mayavadis accept the description of the pastimes of the Lord as stories, but actually they are not stories, they are historical facts. Pure devotees accept the narrations of the pastimes of the Lord not as stories, but as the absolute truth. The words mama parushani are significant. Devotees are very much attached to glorifying the activities of the Lord, whereas the Mayavadis cannot even think of these activities. According to them, the absolute truth is impersonal. Without personal existence, how can there be activity? The impersonalists take the activities mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and other Vedic literatures as fictitious stories, and therefore they interpret them most mischievously. To have no idea of the personality, they have no idea of the personality of Godhead. They unnecessarily poke their noses into the scripture and interpret it in a deceptive way in order to mislead the innocent public. The activities of Mayavadi philosophy are very dangerous to the public, and therefore Lord Chaitanya warned us never to hear from any Mayavadi about any scripture. They will spoil the entire process, and the person hearing them will never be able to come to the path of devotional service to attain the highest perfection, or will be able to do so only after a very long time. It is clearly stated by Kapila Muni that bhakti activities, or activities in devotional service, are transcendental to mukti. This is called panchama purushartha. Generally, people engage in the activities of religion, economic development, and sense gratification, and ultimately they work with an idea that they are going to become one with the Supreme Lord, mukti. But bhakti is transcendental to all these activities. The Srimad Bhagavatam therefore begins by stating that all kinds of pretentious religiosity is completely eradicated from the Bhagavatam. Ritualistic activities for economic development and sense gratification end after frustration and sense gratification. The desire to become one with the Supreme Lord are all completely rejected in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is especially meant for the pure devotees, who always engage in Krishna consciousness, in the activities of the Lord, and always glorify these transcendental activities. Pure devotees worship the transcendental activities of the Lord in Vrindavan, Dwarka, and Mathura, as they are narrated in the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Puranas. The Mayavadi philosophers completely reject them as stories, but actually, they are great and worshipable subject matters, and thus are relishable only for devotees. That is the difference between a Mayavadi and a pure devotee. So now we'll take a few reflections. One thing that you heard so far that stuck in your mind. Hansapriya. Chasing after the kama. It has a beginning and an end, so therefore don't chase after it. Yeah, one has to tolerate these things without being disturbed. I heard Prabhupada give an example the other day that, for instance, if you get on a train and there's a dispute over who gets what seat, because sometimes some of those trains can be kind of crowded, and someone says, that's my seat, and then you end up not getting the seat you wanted, or you didn't get a seat at all. It said that a transcendentalist will think there's only a few hours in the, why fight over it? And he said, then you can tolerate, because you know there's only a few hours, what's the difference? I'm going to be getting off anyway and walking, and you just don't bother with it. And a materialistic person would become completely absorbed. And so this life has a beginning and an end also. And so what's the difference? There's a story Prabhupada used to tell about this sage, who was a very hairy sage. And it said that he would live for one lifetime of Brahma for every hair on his body. And he had these disciples that would come and try to give him all kinds of amenities and wanted to build him a house and everything like that. And he lived very simply with just a loincloth, and he would say, what's the use? I'm only here a short amount of time. And so it depends on one's perspective, how long one's here in the material world. Yes. Go ahead, I'll repeat.
Hare Krishna.
Thanks.
In the start, you talk about prema, which is the final goal of bhakti. You talk about rasa. And I was wondering, like, to have bhav of prema towards somebody, then probably, I believe, you should be very depthful. You feel so much small that you have taken so much from that person that you are feel very humbled or depthful to that person. And because of that humility, probably you get, you want to do something for that person. And the other part is like the rasa, probably which goes to the attractiveness to the person. For example, there are six opulences which we say to the God is most powerful, wealthy and all that, which probably makes the person attractive. And or because of that attractiveness, you get rasa. So my question is like, to develop this prem bhav, which one is that one? Like attractiveness to that person, or is like how much small you feel in front of that person because he has done so much for you?
Well, in the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Narada Muni explains that as one advances towards prema, one develops an equal amount of dainya, which means utter humility, and that practically the two are synonymous, because when you find levels of prema, you'll find the same levels of dainya. And it's a contradiction that or a paradox that those who are becoming more and more advanced feel themselves less and less adequate, and they become more and more humble. So that's a feature of love of God that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu mentioned to Sanatan Goswami when he described bhava, which is just the preliminary stage before love for God awakens in the heart, that one feels oneself unqualified and very humble because of it. And as far as rasa goes, rasa is comes, and one's attraction for the Supreme Personality of Godhead is comes from grace. It's not a matter of a yogic strength or anything like that, but when the Supreme Personality of Godhead sees the submission of a soul towards him, and the soul surrenders to Krishna unconditionally, there's a way in which Krishna reciprocates. And in the process of approaching Krishna in full surrender and hearing about him, there is an infusion of what's called the Sarup Shakti, or the internal potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that enters within the heart of the devotee, and his heart becomes soft at that time. And when the heart becomes soft, then the devotee can begin to experience what is called mellows, or the exchanges of love between he and the Lord. And in the love that the devotees have for Krishna in Vrindavan, the kind of opulence that might normally attract somebody is not there. The power and the grandeur of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is covered, and that actually increases the sense of intimacy, which is called mama. That the devotees in Vrindavan, for instance, consider Krishna to be theirs. He belongs to me. Nanda Maharaj and Yashoda think he's my kid. And the friends all think, you know, he's my best friend. He's mine. And he's our hometown hero and kid, like that. And they deal with him in a very personal way. And the rasa becomes very sweet. And there's a way in which the opulence, you know, even the knowledge that he's God, that he has all these opulences, is covered for the sake of the sweetening of and the intimacy of the rasa. And you find that when you have a very close relationship with somebody, then the opulence begins to diminish, and the formality begins to lessen, because you know them so well, you're so close, that those things are no longer important. Okay? Anything else? Yes, Malini.
Prabhuji, while you were reading, this thing came up that asking anything from the Lord interrupts the rasa between the Lord and the devotee.
What does?
Asking anything.
Oh, asking anything
from
yeah.
the Lord. Uh-huh. Prabhuji, can you please elaborate more on that? Because there is spiritual desires, and sometimes there is something essential for your life. So.
Yeah, asking anything for oneself, you know, one's material benefit, that's certainly. And just a sense also that Krishna knows anyway what I need and want better than I know, so why ask? But it's not altogether, it depends on the quality of the asking, because it's not altogether against the, in fact, it's a symptom of advancement in devotional service that one asks the Lord for a very specific kind of service and begs for that and longs for it. And it's that kind of longing which is evidence of somebody's awakening love for God, that they have a very specific way in which they want to serve the Lord. So that kind of asking is very nice. But you'll, as I give the example often of Gajendra, when he asks the Lord for help because he's being challenged severely by the crocodile, he apologizes. He said, I know your pure devotees don't ask for anything, but I'm in a tough spot right now. So he asks. And actually, in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami says that, actually it's one of the acharyas, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, commenting on Rupa Goswami, says that there's a way in which, because your whole life is for Krishna, if there's a time at which you ask him for something to sustain your life or the life of those who are in your family and so forth, because you're fully engaged in devotional service, he said this is a natural impulse. And therefore, it's not outside the realm of pure devotional service. Besides, your whole life is dedicated to him anyway. And so what's measured by the Lord is one's submissiveness and sincerity. And even in the cases where somebody is, even is distracted from devotional service without planning to, it just comes somehow or other. The Shastra says, Swapada Mulam Bhajata Priyasya Taktanya Bhavasya Hare Priyasaha Vikarma Yachchot Patitam Katanjit Gnutunoti Sarvam Hridi Sannivishtaha. And that is that somehow or other somebody deviates from the path of devotional service and performs some vikarma because his intention is bhava, his feeling is to always be surrendering to the Lord. He didn't intend to do that. Krishna makes up for it because he's within the heart. Sannivishtaha, he's entered there and he already knows what the intention of the devotee is. So intention is quite important in all of these things. But from point of view of the devotee doesn't like to ask anything from the Lord because it disturbs his, concentration on pure service. He just wants to serve the Lord. But asking for more and more service is not disturbing at all. It's actually the essence of our chanting. We're saying, please engage me in your service. And simultaneously, let me become free from distraction ware. I heard this term, distraction ware. Like Facebook is distraction ware. They create it just so you can be distracted. The whole material world's like equipped with distraction ware. Yes, Gandharvika.
Regarding, Regarding that question, suppose if we are making some friends or something, it feels so bad to go and ask a friend, like, can you give me this or can you give me that? Because we feel, before asking, we think maybe that will spoil the relationship like that. But why is it that when we worship Krishna, we always expect that life should be like this? Oh, I have been serving Krishna for so long, why am I not getting that? Is it because of some, I have not identified properly with Krishna, some identification basic problem? Why does that?
Your question is, why do we ask so many things from Krishna?
Yeah, but even with friends, we don't expect anything. If we are real friends, we don't go and ask them for money or home or anything. We just,
well, it depends on
them.
The relationship too. And like little kids, you know, before they start to mature, their tendency is just to ask everything from the parents, and they really don't care what time of day or night it is. Like babies, you know, they just like, gimme, 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 gimme. That's their level of development. Yeah, but when a child becomes more mature later on in life, you know, she starts to think, oh, my parents have done so much for me, let me do something for them in return. And it's much more subtle consideration. And now, you know, out of love, they try to give things to the parents, and they really don't want to take anything. They feel this gratitude. So devotees, when they develop, they begin to consider how kind Krishna is and how all along he's been supporting me. And I asked so many things from him, and I didn't even thank him or anything like that. And, of course, you know, that's sort of natural. And because Krishna can supply everything and is supplying everything, it's natural. With a friend, you might even think, you know, what could he give me anyway?
Because especially while chanting, just considering the holy name as a friend, and like how nice it'll feel to spend time with the friend, you forget the world and you don't know how time passes. But my mind is always thinking about, oh, will that happen or will this happen? That relationship is so difficult to build, but especially with the holy name, to feel that happiness. But from what you're saying, it feels like it's a symptom of advancement to develop that gratitude. When it comes, then we can.
Yeah, that's true. Gratitude. And, you know, it's just one of the steps on the path of surrender is to consider Krishna to be one's maintainer. And one way that one can have a little peace in one's devotional service and not get too distracted is to accept things which come of their own accord naturally and not endeavor for other things so much unless they're directly in the line of service. And then you can, you know, scheme as much as possible to try to get things for Krishna's senses, sense gratification. But for my own sense gratification, learn to be satisfied with whatever Krishna provides naturally. And you can develop a lot of faith from that also by seeing that if I just calm down, I don't get overheated and have to run after everything that I think I need and so forth, that Krishna has a way of providing everything, you know, and gratitude starts to grow from that too, and see that. And Prabhupada used to say all the time, you know, when he left his family and everything like that, he thought, you know, what is this? And then he was saying, and now look, I have so many more children, and they're taking care of me, you know, 100 times better than my other kids would have ever. And, it's, you know, it was out of gratitude that he was saying that to Krishna. Obviously, that he had surrendered everything to the service of Krishna, to the order of his spiritual master, and because of that, you know, he was seeing right in front of him the manifestation of Krishna's reciprocation. And so as devotees practically surrender, as they surrender unto me, Krishna says, I reward them accordingly, and see that Krishna's right there. He doesn't miss anything. He knows perfectly how to reciprocate. The devotee becomes content with that. And not just, you know, ashlishya va paravatam pinashnumam adarshana marma hatam karotu va. Even if Krishna doesn't present something, the mature devotee is still loves Krishna and knows that he's only increasing my desire for him and so forth. Anything else? Yes.
Prabhu, in my experience, I feel that whenever I'm so obsessed with something and I pray to Krishna, Krishna gives it mercifully, but he also purifies me of that desire. So that's why I'm like, you know, I'm very thoughtful before I actually pray for something big. Because I feel, you know, like how sometimes the mother, you know, gives the child and then also gives the message. It lets the child experience, like say, touching the fire hurts, and then the child doesn't listen, and the mother sometimes lets the child experience that. When the child gets hurt, burnt, then it realizes, oh, this is, you know, not, this is what I'm not supposed to do this, like that. So I think we should also be very careful before, because it's very often devotees think, oh, if I have $1 million, you know, I don't have to work, I can just do full-time preaching, and, you know, I can do many things, I can, you know, help build the temple, so many things, but there is a reason why Krishna doesn't give or fulfill those desires, because he knows that by giving them, we may, you know, take it for granted, we may actually fall down from our Krishna conscious position, or he may give it and then teach us, you know, or purify us of that mentality of the desire.
Vrindavan, are you on a marathon running somewhere? Yeah, in the story of Sudama Brahmana, there's many of the subtleties of these things come up. And it's mentioned in that story that Sudama Brahmana was attached a little bit to being austere. So there's a way in which Krishna gave him all this stuff afterwards. And others who are attached to all this stuff, sometimes Krishna takes it all away. Yasyaham anagrinnami harishetat dhanam shanai. When he shows special mercy, he can take away things from the devotee just so they'll have that feeling of utter dependence on him and so forth. And also, it's mentioned in Shastra, if I can remember the verse, satyam dishati artitam artito nirnam naivartato yat punar artitam yata soyam vidate bhajatam anichatam ichapitaram padapalapalavam, which means that when the devotee petitions Krishna over and over again for benedictions and they're not good for the devotee, Krishna fulfills his desire, but he does it in such a way that the devotee won't ask again. And instead, it says, naivartato yat punar artato yata swayam vidate bhajatam anichatam. He gives himself instead. Ichapitaram padapalapalavam. He covers their desire with all this other, you know, mercy, and then he gives his own lotus feet, you know, so the devotee, that's what he ends up with. So akama sarva kama va moksha kama udaradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. Whether one has all desire or no desire or wants liberation, still approach Krishna, because he'll take care of you in the right way. And, you know, if you surrender to him. You had a follow-up?
Just to add to that, I also had this realization recently that sometimes, you know, Krishna wants to give us more, but then we pray for something and, you know, block Krishna's mercy on us by asking something less. So in that case, should we just, maybe it's safe to just pray to Krishna whatever, you know, you want to give.
That's the best prayer. Just say, Krishna, you know better than me, so you give me whatever is best for me. And that seems a little risky, because everyone thinks, what if, you know. But that's the practice of pure devotional service and this selfless prayer, selfless service that we're talking about. You know, that every day, Krishna, you give me exactly what's my medicine, whatever I need to become closer, to get closer to you, and depend upon him. And you can see that he carries what you lack and preserves what you have. Ananyas chintayanto mam yejana paripasate tesham nityabdyuktanam yoga kshemam vaham yaham. If someone just says, and think about this practically, Ananyas chintayantamam. Your chinta, your consciousness, has to go somewhere. It can go into the distraction where, or all so many millions of things it can go into the material world. But Krishna says, Bhogaishvarya prasaktanam taya prahita chetasam vyavasayatmika budhir ekeha kurunandana. That through wanting material enjoyment and the opulence of the world, something to show off, then one can't get that determination to think clearly about Krishna. But ananyas chintayanto mam, if you just abandon other things and say, I'll just think about my service, I'll just think about how to serve the order of my spiritual master and so forth, and just hang on to that and absorb your consciousness in that. I have a little placard on my wall that Pri Kishori made for me, and it's a quote from Srila Prabhupada telling one of his disciples that all the advancement we've made so far has become because of book distribution. So he said, don't deviate your mind even for a second from this. Just keep doing it. I always look up at that and go, okay, just do that. Because the mind wants to run off to so many things, make so many arrangements, so many plans. But it's a rope. If you can just say, there ananyas chintayantamam, no other thing, just this. And just hold on to that one thing. Then Krishna says, I carry what you lack and preserve what you have. It's a really good point. You may ask for so many things and then be careful what you ask for, because you might get what you want, and it may not, and then it'll end up not being what you actually wanted. But if you just surrender to Krishna and do what he wants you to do, you get the order, and then you say, I'll just do that, I'll just focus on that, then Krishna carries what you, he has to. Who else is going to take care of you if you don't take care of yourself? You just, I'm not saying that in a way of being, you know, completely neglectful of whatever duty you have to, you know, take some medicine when you're sick or something like that. But the point is, you're only depending on Krishna for everything. Then he becomes especially responsive to devotees like that. That's the, he says in the Gita, Samoham sarvabhuteshu name dveshosti na priya ye bhajanti tumam bhaktya mai te teshu bhaktya chapyaham. That I'm equal to everybody. He's taking care of everybody equally, but for one who surrenders to me, samaham sarvabhuteshu name dveshosti nabajanti tumam bhaktya, that's what they're into, they just worship Krishna. For that person, they live in me. I mean, they're with me all the time, and he's just completely attentive to everything for the devotee in that situation. Hansapriya.
By no means I'm not asking Krishna for anything, or I'm 100% contained. But I realized that it helps if I have the same thing most of the time. So like if I don't go to mall, I have less temptation of asking for. But if I'm just coming on the weekends, Saturday, Sunday for the services, then it's less asking for material stuff. But I was thinking that more I come on the weekends to the temple, it's more asking for the better stuff. So then selfless, the material asking gets less and less.
Yeah, good formula. Good to know. Is stay absorbed. You know, and the material world has a lot of distractions. So one may be on a very strict path and practice and then get distracted. Bharat Maharaj was at the stage of bhava, but then he saw a deer and a little coochie coochie coo, you know. And next thing you know, he was attached to it. A little jiva gets attached really easily to things. And so we have to be, it's a real balance, you know, how to go through life and, you know, maintain one's focus on Krishna all the time, not be a complete fanatic about, you know, the way we deal socially with others and things like that, but not get distracted at the same time. Avoid bad association, but there's a graceful way to move through life and be fully absorbed in Krishna. We have to be attentive and careful. Like if we know the environment, if I go into that environment, I'll be distracted. I was before. Things have their effects on us. So devotees who are very serious make it a point to avoid situations that might distract them or influence them and ruin their bhajan in a certain way. And therefore, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was asked, what is a devotee? He said, asat sanga tyag, e vaishnava char. That a Vaishnava is somebody who avoids bad association because it has its effect. Yes, Rajesh.
Yes, Prabhuji, just wanted to add to that about association. We have a neighbor or close friend. Whenever, maybe in the last 10 years, we have visited their house, on the same day evening when we come back, we always like, why I didn't invest in India in the property, because I missed the boat, because all their discussion is focused on investing, you know, house, why you didn't buy the house. But glad that the discussion didn't last that long, but that evening for 2 or 3 hours, you know, even I was not mentally, you know, on their board what they were telling, but still it has like, you know, I should have done it. So I think association matters the most, because as you spend 2 hours, they can ruin that 2 hours plus 3 hours extra and maybe more. But luckily it was only contained to that night itself. Thank God it didn't carry forward to the next day. So
this is, you know, Prabhupada used to give an example of these big businessmen. If you ask him for an appointment, it's really hard to get an appointment because they're so busy. And then if they ever do give you an appointment, it's like for 3 minutes. Okay, what do you want? I want to know right now. What do you want? No, forget it. Out. You know, next one. And so he said, devotees, not that we should be like that exactly, but they have that same mentality. They're guarding their time, and they're guarding who they associate with very carefully, because as a wealthy capitalist knows, you know, time is money. And the devotees are aware of this also. But, you know, every second is... that I'm not investing in hearing and chanting or doing my service, I'm losing something so valuable. And anartha kalatvam, avyartha kalatvam, excuse me, is one of the symptoms of advancement in devotional service, which means the devotee won't waste a second. And you can see that in wealthy capitalists who are doing business and things like that. They develop that, but it's just the opposite side, in the spiritual side. They're just like that. And they make sure that, you know, like a businessman who's always thinking about making another dollar, he gets in the car, the conference call. Okay, conference call, you know, how are we going to make that investment? It's all going on. So if you get around, imagine the effect if you get around devotees who are thinking like that, about hearing and chanting, and, you know, at a very high level, then you'll start to feel like that too. You become greedy for spending time for hearing and chanting and things like that. And that's actually how to make advancement. Just as in the negative way, if you associate with materialists, they'll infect you. So in the positive way, pure devotees, satam prasangam mama virya sambido bhavanti hrit karna rasayana katal, they just get in you. You know, it gets in you and it's like, how'd you get like that? It's like hanging out with him. I once met one of my godbrothers who was sort of independent for a long time, but he used to associate with some advanced devotees, and no one really knew that much about where he was and what he was doing and stuff. And I remember he came back and gave a class once at a big temple, and everyone was like, what? That was fantastic. And I was talking to him, he goes, yeah, they don't know I've been hanging out with sadhus, you know. And I could see it in him, you know, I've been hanging out with sadhus, what can I do? That's just what happens. When you hang out with certain people, you become like them. So you know, devotees, you know, they'll know if I'm driving up to the house, the person's going to be there, they'll go around back, you know, they'll put a sign on the door, I'm not home, whatever you have to do to make sure that you don't get disturbed in your bhajan. And Krishna will make arrangements for that too. He can help. He will help. It's a good topic, right? Selfless service. There's another expression of Devahuti, when she begins to inquire from her son Kapiladeva, and she says that I'm tired of the onslaught from the material senses. You know that at the very beginning of her inquiries to Lord Kapiladeva, she said, "I'm tired of the senses." and all their demands and everything. Now I just want to hear from you about pure devotional service and so forth. This is the good position to begin with. One's materially exhausted. Materially exhausted. Nope, I've had enough. This is a real peace, actually. And then from there, one can really begin to focus one's mind and attention on devotional service. And voracious hearing is greatly beneficial. Did you have a point, Shraddha, and I didn't call on you yet? Please.
Actually, there were a couple of things. One was that it's a reflection. One was that I just recovered from illness, so I get terrible cramps in my legs when I, you know, when I'm recovering. So I had the worst possible cramp just when the class started. And then you were saying that the happiness is very short-lived, and I just thought, well, you know, maybe sadness is also very short-lived. And then I just thought that this pain, I mean, it's excruciating pain, but Gajendra had the crocodile for 10,000 years.
You felt like a crocodile was on your leg?
It felt like that, yeah, but then it, you know, it did go away. So the bad things also go away. Second thing which I noticed was that, which I've started noticing off late in my life is, you were mentioning about yoga shema vahameham, I carry what they lack, and I've noticed, I mean, we have to get into the habit of noticing how much Krishna does for us every other moment. Mm. I mean, I've seen that sometimes at work, I'm just about to hit the send button and of an email, and it's a huge mistake in the figures or something like that, or instead of saying not, I'm forgetting the word not and changes the meaning. And I noticed that just before sending this, you know, I will stop somehow, you know, out of my control, I will stop, my eyes will fall on that. And earlier it used to be like, wow, I caught that, but now it's like, no, this is divine intervention, you know, Krishna makes it, you know,
what he does for us.
Yeah, he does.
And sometimes it's what he's at, you know, coming to recognize what he's taking away from us as a benediction, rather than feeling like, why is he doing this to me?
That is so true. And I was thinking about that too when you said that a person is materially exhausted. And I was thinking that when I was young, like when I was a teenager, then, you know, my parents were my worst enemy, and it was like, okay, when I get married, the spouse is the best thing, and then of course you get married and you realize it's not the same. And then you think, oh, then, you know, the kids are the best thing to have, and then they, you know, grow up and they go away. So slowly over a period of time you get exhausted by all that. And then where else do you have to go, you know, other than going to Krishna? Because by definition, he's not all these material things that we encounter. So so that's why I was noticing that a lot of people towards the later end of the life, when they have realized everything and tried their best to control and thought they would enjoy, you know, and everything is, that nothing works, and then they turn to God like that, you know. So we're just thinking that.
Or not. I mean, a lot of people don't become materially exhausted even when it's obvious they should have, which is a... Yeah, it's altogether possible if one maintains that. I mean, you could see sometimes people, they'll do everything they can to enhance their body. Nowadays, there's so many things. You can have plastic surgery, put in collagen, and, you know, there's injections for, I forget what it's called, Botox, so the wrinkles don't show so much. And so I've seen, you know, wealthy people sometimes, they put a lot into that. And even to the very end of life, they're still trying to arrange a way to be happy. So it's not automatic that just because one gets old and loses everything, he becomes detached, you know? Prabhupada talked about seeing in Howrah Station a homeless person with all he had to his in his possession was some half-burned firewood, but he was guarding it like anything, like, you know, this was the greatest possession and everything. And, you know, one might think, well, you have nothing to lose, but still, whatever little thing I have in the material world, I think, well, it's mine, so I'm going to keep it. And I don't become aware of the fact that I'm living a very meager existence and so forth. So it's good fortune also that comes, as mentioned by Mahaprabhu when he says, when he's talking to Sanatana Goswami, when one becomes fortunate, then he begins to seek out the association of devotees, and that fortune comes in the form of exhaustion, you know, material exhaustion, no longer interested. That's the wealthiest person who's no longer interested in anything material. Then you don't have to chase it anymore. And when you see other people chasing after you, you think, like, what's the point? Poor, you know, feel compassion. That you can see, obviously, that it's a lower stage of consciousness. And you could feel compassion. That they're endeavoring so hard for something that's not going to give them happiness anyway. And then you can give them something practical, like spiritual knowledge, or some prasadam, or teach them about spiritual life and something like that, so they can really actually develop something. But Prabhupada talked about this, how there were, you know, even up to the time of death, a man might continue to hold that, you know, lusty desires in his heart or something like that. And how, you know, there was a king and Akbar, yeah, he was talking, he's saying, so they did an experiment and he showed that it was true and he said, was amazed by it and stuff. Yes, Sukeshwari.
Hare Krishna Prabhu. So I was thinking about the point that you just mentioned about showing compassion to others. Sometimes I feel compassionate about myself when I think that I understand all this stuff about Krishna consciousness, and still I see that sometimes my mind will just take me away from things that are not at all related to Krishna. And you know, after some time I realize that I just feel compassionate that, you know, I am not able to keep myself totally fixed onto Krishna consciousness, and then I need to do it and then I pray again. And you know, it's like up and down, a seesaw game that goes on and on. And you know, so my question is, when would this end?
Well, at the end of anartha nivritti, there's a way in which, in the beginning, there's faith. That faith comes by the agyata sukriti. Somehow you get some good fortune in associating with a devotee, doing some service, and then even unknowingly, you get this credit by association with a devotee. And then that makes your good fortune. So in some life, then you awaken to this faith, the Shraddha. It means you have an inclination towards doing devotional service, and then you want to associate with devotees. And that's a really happy time, because you realize, this is who I want to be with. And you know where you're going in life. It's with them. Wherever they go, I want to be like them. I want to be with them. And then when you come into association of devotees, just like in any society, you'll be expected to do something. And that's the bhajana kriya, where you take up, you know, a vow that I'm going to do the regulated life and the work it takes in devotional service to advance. I'll follow tat-tat karma pravartana. I'll do all the activities that the great sadhus have done. Acharyopasanam, I'll follow in the footsteps of the great acharyas. I'll take this path. Whatever it is, I'm going to take it. That determination is very great, and it comes in. One takes vows, becomes initiated, begins chanting a certain number of rounds and things like that. And then right after that, anartha nivritti. And there's two stages of anartha nivritti. One is unsteady and the other steady. One comes past anartha nivritti, one comes to steadiness or nishta. That's just past anartha nivritti. So there's this battle that takes place at that point where I've surrendered, I've come into the association of devotees, and now I've made a vow. And now you stand and fight. And now you have to go through this period of anishta bhajana kriya, where you face all these demons that are holding you back. They are previous impressions from association we've had in the past, and from all the kinds of activities we've engaged in before. All those are, the impressions of those things are still in the body. The sins are done, but the impressions stay there. And we have to gradually those have to become purged as we go on with the process of devotional service. And that's done primarily by hearing and chanting. This Srinvatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hridyantak Stohi Bhadrani Vidhunoti Suritsatam. Krishna within the heart, as we hear and chant about him, helps us to sort out these different material desires, and he helps us to vanquish them. And then, Nashta Prayeshu Bhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishti. Practically to nil, not completely. So it's like after this Anarta Nivritti, means we have all these desires and we're winnowing them out from our system, from our consciousness and so forth, we come to the point of Nishta. Shta means you have a place to stand. You can stand on your own 2 feet. So the fire's out, but smoke is still there. You could still see, you can tell for yourself, in fact. You can say, now I know, I feel that I can stand on my own 2 feet. I'm not no longer dissuaded by these material desires, but you can still see that they might even be there, but you're no longer interested, and you feel strength. You know for yourself. Nishta ruchi. And then after nishta, then the positive spiritual life begins to happen, which means the taste begins to come to the devotee. And the devotee then becomes voracious about hearing and chanting and wants to hear and chant more and is really attracted to the holy name and to the topics about Krishna and the Bhagavatam and to living in the holy dham, is preoccupied by all these things. And there are other, there's a positive flow of taste in the devotee. And there are different levels of ruchi also. You know, someone's very attracted to the holy name, but it has to be sung in a certain way. But then in higher stages of ruchi, he doesn't care how it's sung. He cares who sings it, but not how it's sung. And he just wants to be around and hear the holy name and so forth, becomes attracted. And then becomes asakti or attachment, ruchis tata, tato bhava asakti, and then the higher levels of prema and so forth. And all these are described. So you should know the different stages, what the steps are. And you can study minutely in the Madhurya Kadambini, for example, the various symptoms of anarta nivritti. And if you study them and you look at them in yourself, you'll feel a little bit okay. Not in the sense that I still have these things, but you'll feel okay in the sense that I'm making progress. I'm going to come through this. It's like when you have a disease. The worst thing is when it's undiagnosed. And you go to every doctor and they say, I have no idea. I don't know why you're vomiting up blood. You know, we can't even tell. Then you just feel horrible. You know, but when someone says, I know what it is. This is what it is. And it's going to take you 2 weeks to get better. Then it's all right, 2 weeks, that's all right, I'll just go through it. Then you know there's light at the end of the tunnel. Sorry to use the cliche, but there it is. And then, you know, when we can understand these different symptoms, we can understand that it's diagnosed and that if I keep going in this direction, I'll come to that point, then you have a better than even chance of getting there in this lifetime. You're welcome. Yes.
I was hearing one of the Prabhupada was telling, even though if you feel that you're purified, especially coming to the association, say suppose if you're purified, there are two things. He was talking about maybe the process of devotion, which is very important through association. Hearing and chanting, it's nice. So say, suppose if you're purified, still you come to association. Why do you come to association? For inspiration. Okay, so it's not just purification. Even inspiration is most important during purification. It's like, you know, without association, with a purity, oh yeah, that's right. But any time Maya can attack. So we have to be in the association for the inspiration.
Yeah, nice. Good point. Without higher association, without being around those who are more advanced than us, then, you know, we may not get that impetus to advance to the next level. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advised us to associate with like-minded devotees who are more advanced than ourselves. And in that kind of association, we make good progress. Does anybody know where we are in the Ramayana? Yes, please go ahead.
I had a question. So okay. Every time I hear the like-minded devotees, what do we mean by like-minded devotees?
Those devotees who have a similar sentiment for the kind of devotional service that you do, serving in the same way. There are groups in the spiritual world called gunas. Everyone's got their own little group. I mean, even in an International Society for Krishna Consciousness, there are different devotees that we may be more attracted to associating with because they're like-minded. Like-minded about service, like-minded about the mood of surrender and so forth. These kinds of things. But at, you know, higher levels of advancement may become even more pronounced, that they have a predilection for the kind of devotional service that they're practicing in the spiritual world, and maybe, you know, will be attracted to associating with those devotees too. This is described in the Upadeshamrita, how when one, this is well past anartanda vritti, and you know, is not to be imitated at any time while there's still material desires within the heart. But one who is getting a positive, who has a taste for devotional service and begins to have a very specific taste for practicing and following, begins to follow the kind of devotional service practiced by certain associates of Krishna in the spiritual world. And there may be others who are in that mood as well. And therefore one would naturally gravitate towards them. Yes.
Prabhu, you talked about the different stages, right? From Shraddha to Prema. And you also gave a very nice analogy about the patient who feels that, okay, in 2 weeks' time when he's diagnosed correctly, he feels confident that he will be cured. I was, also you mentioned that, okay, in this lifetime you can achieve that. So I was wondering, you know, for in corporate life, we have intermediate goals. Like if you have to launch a product in 2 years, right? I know that, okay, I have to actually get to this stage by 6 months, after this another 8 months. Something has to happen, otherwise I'm going to miss the target. Should we also actually look at achieving these stages? I mean, I don't know whether it is a correct thing approach at all, my particular timelines. Otherwise the sense of urgency might not come. But then equating it to something mundane and even thinking that you have achieved a particular stage itself might be a fallacy. So what is your suggestion on that?
Well, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur talks about chanting the holy name. And he says that just as a fruit on a tree ripens in its own time, and you can't really rush it. Like I just put in an apple tree yesterday, Fuji apple, by the way. And it's a little tree, so I don't know when it's going to come out with any fruit. But I can't come out there and demand anything from it yet. I have to feed it a lot. I have to water it. You know, it may take a few seasons before it comes out. And there are different reasons why the fruit comes out, you know, more quickly than on some trees than others. It may be, you know, there are various circumstances. So also Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that there are different reasons why some people get a taste sooner than others. Sometimes it's Krishna's arrangement. Sometimes he holds it back for various reasons from various devotees, because it's very an individual process. It's not, I mean, even in the corporate world, you may say, I have to do it in a certain amount of time, but it still depends on so many different human interactions and things like that. But in spiritual life, we do the best we can with what we have out of sincerity, and we depend on Krishna for the time scale and the results and so forth. And even in that, when a devotee is certain in his or her heart that I'm going to surrender to Krishna, you've decided, even if you haven't been able to execute it fully, once you've decided that I'm going to do that, then the nectar begins to pour because you're surrendering. And you understand from that position that nothing can hinder my progress from this point, because the only hindrance we have to our progress is our own attachment to the material world and to staying here in the material world. Once you dump that baggage, there's nothing to really slow you down anymore. And so my point is that work begun is half done. Who said that? Work begun is half done. Some great personality, I forget who. But work begun is half done. So the beginning of the whole thing is you have to surrender. Pardon me?
Well begun, I think. Well begun is half done.
When?
Well begun.
Well begun is half done. Something. Okay. Page 14. And for those of you who are online, it's 650-245-7018. 650-245-7018. Please give us a Hari Bol through the text, because we'd like to know that you're out there. We miss you. Okay, and what page is it? 14. We're almost done. Well begun is half done. I'm sorry I stalled so much. I just felt like talking to everybody. But I told Malini, I said, this time we'll take instead of like every night, little bit, we'll take a Saturday, a couple Saturdays, and we'll do 5-6 hours and stuff like that. And then I looked at my schedule and I said, I don't have any Saturdays. Then I started getting all morose. Hare Krishna, Damodar Prabhu. So nice to see you. It's the first time I've actually seen him since I got back.
Pratibha Mataji is sending 2 Hari Bols.
Jai! We're missing Pratibha Mataji also. She was down here for the whole weekend. That was a treat. Nice. Okay, page 14, right? We're continuing in our perpetual reading of the Ramayana. We don't have that much further to go, just this much. So, we're in the story I can see right now of Romapad Maharaj getting Rishishinga to come to his capital because, oh my goodness, okay. Because there was getting no rain, he made an offense, and to clear the offense, he needed a completely pure personality. Rishishinga was that personality. He had been raised in a family where actually his father had had bad luck with women. And because of that, he decided that his son, Rishishinga, would never be exposed to women at all. So there were no females in the household. And he did, even in the tract of land he lived in, he didn't let any female animals come into the in purview and so forth. But there was this scheme to get Rishishinga because it was said that he was such a pure personality, if he came to the kingdom of Romapad Maharaj, then the rains would come back and prosperity would come immediately because of his purity. That's the power of a very pure person. And so they sent these heavenly damsels at a time. He used to be, his father would watch over and protect him all the time, but he had to go out sometime to go to do some, you know, chores. And so the Hari Bols are coming in now. So they sent some apsaras, these heavenly beautiful women, to come there. And they started playing around. And he just thought they were great sages. And so he invited them into the ashram and started serving them and everything like that. And they affected him, you know, he was serving them, and he thought, "Boy, these are really nice sages, but I really feel different about them than any other kind of sages," and so forth. And then, you know, he started feeling separation from them when they weren't there. So they said, "Well, why don't you just come with us?" You know, and he said, "All right, I'll come." So they took him away, and they brought him to the place of Romapad Maharshi. As soon as he got there, then, you know, the rains came, prosperity came back, and everything like that. He ended up getting married, by the way. So, anyway, this is, I think, right in the middle of the story of Rishyashringa. Unable to think of anything else, the following day, Rishyashringa went to the prostitute's camp. The girls received Rishyashringa with great delight and then explained, "This is not our real home. Please come aboard our magnificent floating hermitage and accompany us to a place where we will be able to entertain you in a much better fashion. We have many nice varieties of fruits and roots, and we shall pass the time so enjoyably that you will hardly be able to perceive how time is passing." Being captivated at heart, Rishyashringa unhesitatingly accompanied the prostitutes. Thus, the women allured him back to the capital of Romapad within the kingdom of Anga. Indeed, even as Rishyashringa was being carried down the Ganga, Indra began to send forth showers of rain, giving joy to all the living creatures. As soon as he understood that Rishyashringa had arrived, King Romapad came out from his palace and bowed down before the young Rishi. Then, after worshipping Rishyashringa with great attention, Romapad escorted him into the inner apartments of his palace, where he presented his daughter to the Rishi in charity. When he could understand that Rishyashringa was fully satisfied, Maharaj Romapad begged from him the benediction that neither he nor his father would show their wrath toward him because of the duplicitous manner in which he had allured Rishyashringa away from home. Rishyashringa gave the king his assurance, and thereafter the marriage between him and Shanta was celebrated with great festivity. After the wedding, the newly married couple continued to live in Maharaj Romapad's palace and thus passed their days happily in royal comfort. Sumantra concluded his narration to Maharaj Dasarath, "O King, Sanat Kumar predicted that you would take help from your friend Romapad by requesting him to allow Rishyashringa to come to the kingdom of Kosala and perform a horse sacrifice. It was further indicated that after the performance of the horse sacrifice, you would gain the fulfillment of your desires by receiving 4 incomparable sons." Maharaj Dasarath was very pleased to hear this story from Sumantra. Then, without delay, he went with his retinue to the kingdom of Anga. There he was received by Maharaj Romapad with great respect, and at that time the king of Anga informed Rishyashringa that Dasarath was his real father-in-law. After enjoying Romapad's hospitality for about 1 week, Maharaj Dasarath addressed his friend as follows: "For a long time I have been morose on account of not having a son to perpetuate my illustrious dynasty. Now I beg you to allow Rishyashringa to come to Ayodhya to perform a horse sacrifice on my behalf." Romapad happily agreed, and Maharaj Dasarath soon returned to his capital with Rishyashringa and Shanta. Then, when spring arrived, Maharaj Dasarath humbly approached Rishyashringa, begging him for instructions regarding the performance of the horse sacrifice. Thus, preparations for the sacrifice commenced, and a site was selected on the northern bank of the river Sarayu. The system was for an emperor to send a challenge horse all over the world to establish his supremacy over subordinate kings. The horse would be accompanied by soldiers of the emperor, and upon its arrival in a kingdom, the local king would either have to offer tribute to the emperor's representatives or fight to capture the horse. Any ruling prince or king was at liberty either to express his tacit willingness to obey the emperor or to accept the challenge and thus disobey the supremacy of the particular emperor. One who accepted the challenge had to fight with the emperor's men and establish his own supremacy by victory. The defeated challenger would have to sacrifice his life, making place for another king or ruler. Only when the horse returned after touring the world with no more challenges left could a horse sacrifice begin. Understanding that King Janak would be the future father-in-law of his sons, Maharaj Dasharath sent him the first invitation. Likewise, other subordinate kings were requested to attend the sacrifice. After one full year, the challenge horse returned to Ayodhya, having wandered over the earth under the protection of 400 princes. Only then could the sacrifice begin. Understanding that King Janak would be the future father-in-law of his sons, Maharaj Dasharath sent him the first After the preliminary rites had been performed, Maharaj Dasharath's eldest queen, Kaushalya, circumambulated the challenge horse, which was tied to one of the sacrificial stakes. Then, with three strokes of a sword, she severed the horse's head as prescribed by scriptural injunction. Thereafter, Rishyasringa offered the fat of the dead horse into the sacrificial fire. Maharaj Dasharath was directed to inhale the fumes to free him from all sins. Then the assisting priest offered the limbs of the horse into the sacrificial fire, bringing the three-day sacrifice to an end. Maharaj Dasharath then gave away the four directions of the earth in charity to the four chief priests. The brahmanas returned the gifts, however, saying, "O king, we are devoted to the Vedic study, and the performance of austerities and have no interest in ruling over a kingdom. Therefore, please give us other gifts like cows and gold." Rishyasringa then approached Maharaj Dasharath, saying, "My dear king, you will surely receive four glorious sons. However, I propose that a separate sacrifice known as Putreshta be performed for that purpose." Maharaj Dasharath readily assented, and soon the sacrifice was begun. Meanwhile, in the higher planets, the chief demigods approached Lord Brahma and explained, "O grandsire, because of your benedictions, Ravana has become so powerful that he is harassing everyone at will. Even we cannot subdue the wicked Rakshasa. Therefore, we request you to personally devise the means for his destruction." Lord Brahma considered the situation and then replied, "At the time of asking for benedictions, Ravana did not bother to ask for immunity from death at the hands of human beings, for he considered them to be too insignificant." While Brahma was thinking how Ravana could be killed, Lord Vishnu suddenly appeared, riding on his carrier, Garuda. As effulgent as many suns, Lord Vishnu appeared in his four-armed form, dressed in bright saffron garments and carrying his disc, conch, club, and lotus flower. The demigods worshipped the Supreme Lord with great reverence and then requested, "O Master of the universe, please come to our rescue by dividing yourself into four, becoming the sons of Maharaj Dasharath for the purpose of killing Ravana." Lord Vishnu replied, "Rest assured, there is no longer any need to be afraid. I will soon incarnate to rule over the earth for 11,000 years after vanquishing your enemy, the king of the Rakshasas." After saying this, Lord Vishnu disappeared as the demigods looked on with wonder. Meanwhile, from the sacrificial fire of Maharaj Dasharath, there appeared an exceptional being of dark complexion with all auspicious bodily features. This personality appeared to be unlimitedly powerful. He was decorated with transcendental ornaments, and in his hand he carried a large golden pot of sweet rice. That divine person then told Maharaj Dasharath, "I am a messenger of Lord Vishnu." Ramananda, you know, we need Ram Leela pictures for when we're reading the Ramayana. Yeah?
When we hear these incarnations and their arrival, why is it always Lord Vishnu who predicts that I will come as Rama, I will come as Krishna, and yet we say that Krishna is the Adi
Bhagavan? He's described as the gateway. He comes through the gateway. So just because somebody comes through a doorway, that doesn't mean the door is the origin of that person. They came from some place else. So similarly, in the Shastra, Laghu Bhagavatamrita, and other places, it's described how the Lord appears through the gateway, that way. Yes.
Prabhuji, I, you know, just by reading Srimad Bhagavatam, we hear about plenary expansions. We hear about incarnations. We also hear about Narayana, Vishnu. Can you give us a small gist about first Krishna, then the Chaturvyuha, then after that, then talk about Garbhodakshayi, Kshirodakshayi, and Karanodakshayi. So from whom do all the other incarnations emanate? And if, I mean, from the beginning, if we can just have...
That's easy, Krishna.
Because recently we were just reading in, for the Bhakti Vaibhava class, we were reading about Vishnu and Krishna difference and things like that. So it's a very big topic, and many people do ask, what, who is Narayana, then who is Vishnu? You know, we know that Narayana is Krishna in office and things like that, but as it's said in scriptures, who emanates from whom, and the
Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate iti madhva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. Krishna says, everything emanates from me. The wise who know this perfectly engage in my full devotional service with all their hearts. And Krishna is the origin of everyone, including all the Vishnus. Balaram, he first expands into Balaram, and then the Chaturvyuha, Sankarshan, Mahasankarshan, the second Chaturvyuha, then all the Purushas. And then there are all these different avatars that come, Manvantara avatars, Yuga avatars and so forth, but they're all, their origin is, they all originate in Krishna. And if you read Krishna Lila, then you can understand how that's from an aesthetic point of view, which is the way that the Goswamis explain how Krishna is the origin of everyone, because he has more qualities. From that point of view also, not just the technological, you know, examination of the different levels, but also Krishna has qualities that Lord Vishnu doesn't have, that are four, that he has this sweetness in his pastimes, and sweetness in his flute playing, and his association with the devotees, and Lila Madhurya, Venu Madhurya, and his form is extremely sweet. Sweet, sweet, sweet. Madhuram, Madhuram. Pardon me? Defines the pastimes? The qualities? These have been analyzed by the Goswamis, have given us these different qualities. You can read in the Nectar Devotion how the qualities of Lord Vishnu are delineated, the qualities of Lord Shiva are delineated, and Krishna has the most qualities. And those four are special, very, very special. And
what? One more. I was just thinking that we know about, well, the material manifestation takes place about Karanodakshayi, Garbhodakshayi, and Kshirodakshayi Vishnus. So is this understanding right that those three Vishnus are actually not present in Vaikuntha planets? I mean, like, you know, we have Vaikuntha Loka for Varaha, for Narasimha.
Yeah, they're also not really present in the material world either, because as the Brahma Samhita describes, they don't actually touch the material energy because they're completely transcendental. Even when you see Lord Vishnu comes to this world, his feet don't touch the ground. When he met Prithu Maharaj and Prithu Maharaj was offering his prayers, everyone noticed, hey, his feet never touched the ground. And Mahavishnu glances over the material energy. That's the only contact he really has. But other than that, no contact. But yes, they are concerned. Jagadishwar, these are the secondary names of God because they're non-different from Krishna. They're all the same. Departure eva hita shantanam abhipeta dipayate varvita heta samana dharma yas tadrage vichta vishna chaya abhipat govindamadi purushantam aham bhajami. But there's one original candle that lights all the other candles. But the Vishnus in the material world, they have these, they have their work is to oversee the material energy and the material world, all the goings on here. And so the names of Krishna in the spiritual world are much more intimate because of the relationship he has with his devotees. And, the pastimes there are his personal pastimes. Just like we've pointed out many times, it's a nice example about nicknames. You have your official name, and then you have your legal name that you would tell the guy at the immigration, and you're not going to tell him your nickname. But there's people that know you, and they know you're the inside thing, you know. And they're the intimate ones. So there's a place in the spiritual world where the devotees are so intimate with Krishna that these names are very special. They're like the most intimate of all the names, and the pastimes there are very special. And that's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to teach everybody, is that beyond the material world and beyond even Vaikuntha, there's a place where he's doing it. Okay, Ramananda. Haribala. There's a place where the devotees worship Krishna with such a loving feeling and closeness that is the most special. Just there's a BBT painting? Oh, just on the wall. Oh, that's nice. We're so lucky to have those paintings, you know. So lucky. They're deities unto themselves, just priceless. Meanwhile, from the sacrificial fire of Maharaj Dasarath, there appeared an exceptional being of dark complexion with all auspicious bodily features. This personality appeared to be unlimitedly powerful. He was decorated with transcendental ornaments, and in his hand he carried a large golden pot of sweet rice. That divine person then told Maharaj Dasarath, "I am a messenger of Lord Vishnu." With folded hands, the king replied, "O Vishnu Duta, please order me to perform whatever service I can render." The servant of Lord Vishnu said, "This pot of sweet rice is the reward for your two sacrificial performances. Give portions to your three wives to eat. Through them you shall beget four sons who will forever perpetuate your fame." Maharaj Dasarath happily accepted the sweet rice and circumambulated the Vishnu Duta. After Lord Vishnu's messenger disappeared from view, Maharaj Dasarath quickly gave portions of the sweet rice to his wives, for he was eager to have sons. Maharaj Dasarath gave Kaushalya one half of the sweet rice, Sumitra one fourth, and Kaikeyi one eighth. Then, after some deliberation, he gave the remaining eighth to Sumitra. All three wives were overjoyed, for they were confident that they would soon become mothers. The three queens eagerly ate their shares, and soon thereafter each felt the presence of divine offspring within their wombs. When Maharaj Dasarath understood that his wives were pregnant, he too became very satisfied. Meanwhile, Lord Brahma ordered the demigods as follows: "Beget partial manifestations of yourselves to assist Lord Vishnu in his forthcoming incarnation. The children which you produce in the form of monkeys by uniting with apsaras, she-monkeys, and female yakshas, nagas, vidyadharas, and other celestial beings must be capable of assuming any form at will and must possess all other mystic powers. In addition, they must be very intelligent, highly skilled in the use of weapons, having prowess almost equal to Lord Vishnu, and possess ethereal bodies." After receiving the order of Lord Brahma, Indra begot Vali, Surya begot Sugriv, Brihaspati begot Tara, Kuvera begot Gandamada, Vishvakarma begot Nala, Varuna begot Shushena, and Vayu begot Hanuman. Besides these principal monkeys, Hanuman ki jai! Nobody's cooler than Hanuman. Many thousands of others took birth to assist Lord Vishnu in his mission. All of them were gigantic like mountains and were very eager to fight with Ravana. Like the demigods who begot them, these monkeys were born just after conception. They were so powerful that they could agitate the ocean with their impetuous energy. Now I know why I didn't start, because I would become so attached. Well, we have to leave it there because we have some awards to give out. I know, Malini, that's a shame, huh? So far behind now. There's here at ISV, we have a Sanskrit school. Isn't that correct? We have a Sanskrit school. I don't know if there are any other Sanskrit schools like it in the Bay Area or anywhere in California. But some of the graduates are here, and there are certificates to give out, and this is really an accomplishment. So we're going to have the teachers and the administrators come up and show us who won. Vrindavan, did you win something? And in the meantime, while we're getting organized, Shraddha Devi Dasi will tell us who texted in. You missed your cue. We were reading about some of the associates.
We have Bishwa Prabhu, Ropali, and Rohini. They're saying, Dandavats Prabhu, we are watching your wonderful class online. Thank you so much.
Hare Krishna.
Pratibha Mataji is thanking you for the kind words you said about her. And we have Radha Venkat Prabhu from Sacramento.
Oh, joy.
He says, Hari Bol, I'm listening in.
Hare Krishna.
Yeah, that's all.
Okay. That's all. And Gandharvika?
Just these four lines felt like a big news for me. I just thought I'll read about hearing. This is from the same book in the introduction. Prabhupada says, by hearing the narration of the pastimes of the Lord, one contacts directly the personality of Godhead, and by hearing about the personality of Godhead from within, all accumulated sins of the mundane creature are cleared. The whole idea is that simply by hearing about the Lord's pastimes, one can become one of the associates of the Lord. I was like stunned by hearing that.
Stunning, isn't it? And it's absolutely true. And so this dedication to ongoing hearing and chanting, and then just taking in as much as possible is the real system for becoming advanced in devotional service. Thank you. That was beautiful. I was also reflecting on how they performed the yajna, and just after that, Vishnu Duta appeared and handed them the pot, and then everything came from that. So everything comes from the yajna. If you perform the right kinds of yajna, then advancement in devotional service comes. All spiritual paraphernalia that you'd been hoping for to serve the Lord with will come. And this temple is a result of that, of just doing the yajna. And it's just the size we need right now. And everything's just the way it should be when you do the yajna, not more, not less. And as you continue, Krishna will eternally continue reciprocating in these ways. And especially, we're worshiping Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and he is giving out the highest relationships with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Never been done before. So the Sankirtan Yajna is the thing. It's the main thing. Well, who's coming up to give awards out? Oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah, Vrindavan Priya Prabhu also says Hari Bol, and he's so excited he's coming to join us here.
Jai! Okay, so now what we're going to do is put away all the books and asans and stands, and we'll have a evening artik ceremony. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Shri Ramayana ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Nacharyar marman, Nacharyar marman, Nacharyar marman, Nacharyar marman. Hey, Nacharyar marman, Nacharyar marman, Nacharyar marman, Nacharyar marman.